This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Okay, so hello everyone and welcome to the Collecting Papunya Art Public Conversation, the last of the public programs to accompany the Papunya Painting Exhibition, which is also closing today. So just to recap, we actually have some images running throughout the talk, and these will show Papunya the place, Papunya paintings being prepared for exhibition, the paintings themselves and some details, and then finally some installation shots of Papunya paintings out of the desert, the exhibition. Next, I'd like to introduce the chair for today, Margot Neal, sitting in the centre there. And Margot is Principal Advisor to the Director here at the National Museum and a Senior Curator. She's also a Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for Historical Research here and Adjunct Professor in the History Program through the Australian Centre for Indigenous History. She was the former Director of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Program, and they were responsible for managing the opening of the Gallery of First Australians in 2001. She is co-editor of the Oxford Companion to Aboriginal Art and Culture and is currently curating a major international Aboriginal art exhibition in Japan for 2008 called Emily. Okay, over to you, Margot.
Thank you. And this is, as Elise said, the final program, unfortunately, for the Papunya Tula show, which has been excessively successful. You know, and I'll give you a few little quotes. I'll print off a marketing thing for you. Before I proceed, I'd like to acknowledge that we're standing on the lands of the Ngunnawals and Ngambri peoples of this region, and also to welcome all of you people here today. This is really is crowded house, as they say. It's fantastic. I haven't seen this many people in this room for a very long time, which also attests to the success of the Papunya painting exhibition. And I'd like especially to welcome Mr. and Mrs. Behan in the front room. They are Canberra identities who have run a gallery called Chapman Galleries here until recently for some 30 years. So I'm sure when we get into the conversation component of today, they will be very they'll be good contributors. That's going to put them on the spot, isn't it? So, as you know, it's about collecting today, and collecting also assumes marketplaces, and it particularly will focus on the Papunya show. But I will give you a little bit of a rundown on some of the responses. They're fantastic. They're all positive, and even though some ask a few questions, they can be answered today if those people are here or other people are here who have similar questions. So, you know, we get things like people flying in from Perth just to see the show. We got people, in fact, the couple who came in from Sydney who flew, are the art lecturers from Perth. There's a Sydney couple or two couples who came in recently who heard also that the Emily exhibition was opening in Japan very soon, actually, this month. They said to their husbands, well, I guess we have to go to Tokyo next. And the husband said, well, sounds like a good idea. So we might be sort of doing a bit of global guruing with our exhibitions from this point forward. Now, one of the questions, I mean, there's heaps of things like the best Aboriginal art show I've ever seen. And this is being taped, unfortunately, but the NGA could probably learn something. I'm not saying this, I'm simply reading. And, you know, inspirational, been back five times every day from 9 o'clock. There's a particular artist who came here every day at 9 o'clock, you know, to inspire himself. And then there's heaps of comments about the well hung. Well, that's an interesting expression. great ambience sounds, and then some people had a bit of an issue about the sounds interfering with their contemplative mood. So, well, that's fair enough for some. But you know, the expletives were just amazing. But then there were some interesting meaty things like, oh, this breath mesmerising, breathtakingly impressive, and so on. And then I congratulate all those involved, which of course includes our guest curator Vivian Johnson here. Professor Elkin, one man says, whose fieldwork with Aborigines covered this period 1920 to the time he lectured me at the Australian School of Pacific Administration 66, informed me that the religion was the prerogative of Aboriginal men and accordingly only the men would be aware of the secret life of the group. Now, this person said, however, this was avoided in the section on women's, on the women's part in the collection, on the exhibition, and when it was stated that women were not included because of a lack of resources. Now, this person thought that lessened the credibility of the show and the publication. Vivian will be able to have a little chat about that. Geoffrey Barden was not given adequate recognition for his role in creating the inspiration to paint, and they go on to say, without him, there would not have been any art. That's quite a controversial statement. You know, what it assumes, of course, is there's no Indigenous agency in it at all. But, you know, these are valid questions from people whose experience enables them to say that or not. And there was another, a similar, actually was interesting, because another one commented on, he was a friend of Geoff Barden and goes on to talk about Geoff's attributes. And then he said, I was disappointed in the lack of information on Geoff Barden. Without his work with the Aboriginal people, the art movement would almost certainly not have taken place, yet this was almost entirely overlooked in the exhibition and the museum book. There was only one painting from the crucial period under Geoff, and I'm sure he would be hurt by this. So they're very reasonable questions if you're not deeply involved or haven't read the book very well. And various other things. It just goes on and on. And at the moment, there's something like, I think they're up to... this exhibition, by the way, has only been open for, I think, 65 days, which is very short for a museum and probably... And particularly because of it's not the average museum show, whilst it will soon become so. Up until this point, it isn't. So the numbers... we have something like 700 to 1,000 people a day, and this is little old Canberra, and there's up to about 50,000 visitors to date. So the museum is really, really pleased with that, and I'm particularly pleased with that because I've always had an issue with this border between museums of the 21st century and art galleries, particularly in relation to Indigenous materials, that one must fit into the gallery but not into the museum environment. So blurring the boundaries is what has happened. And museums, of course, as you'll see, can often give extra dimensions to the story that may not occur in the more traditional art gallery that is fairly focused on minimal information and aesthetics primarily. So this exhibition, I think, not that I'm biased anyway, but this exhibition clearly does both very well. So I'll just like to introduce you to our guests today, but before I do, just to say that the NMA collection here that's in the exhibition space is unique among the many holdings of Papunya works in the country, and it does cover the period from 74 to 81. Thus, for those who... worked it out is the answer to one of the questions we just had. There was no market for them at the time, and these were commissioned, which Vivian will tell you more about. But probably what is really significant, and I hope the import of that has sort of hit home, is that most have not been seen by an Australian audience in the three decades since they were produced. So it really is. In fact, we originally were going to, Vivian and I at least, we're going to call it the lost chapter of Papunya, or I think Vivian wrote somewhere, the buried treasures. So that's all part of the whole story. And of course, the interesting thing for Vivian to present this in the museum context was how to avoid the old ethnographic paradigms and show it as contemporary art by giving information as well. So there's this interesting dichotomy that really shouldn't exist, but it does. So it's more than just art, or it's beyond just art. John McDonald, in one of the reviews, called it, you know, if you ever want to see the masters of Aboriginal art, then this is the exhibition to see them. This is the masters. So while over the road at the National Gallery, you can see all the contemporary young emerging artists from right across the country. In this exhibition, you do see the masters. Now, the nature of a public conversation, as I see it, is to encourage everyone, when I stop talking, to engage in a sort of a conversation with our guests. And so there'll be lots of opportunity for interaction. And don't hesitate to get into the hard questions. And there may well be some sensitivities, and people have different ideological positions on things, Indigenous art. But, you know, feel perfectly free to say what you need to say or ask what you want to ask, and I'm sure everyone will treat everyone else's views with the respect it deserves. And so some lively exchanges, a bit of friction and fun and frisson and friskiness would be great. Don't ramble like I am. I'm just showing you how not to do it. And get to the point. Because there's a lot of people. We have 1 hour. We have
45 minutes.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the nature of collecting and collections first, and then we'll talk about, and they may well all get mixed up and we don't care, Papunya Tula and that particular collections and the history thereof. Now, Vivian and them may choose to answer the questions without addressing the question at all, and that's fine. Now, I'll just introduce these two peoples to you, for those who don't know them. Anyway, as far as I'm concerned, they've both been colleagues for a good 15 years, and very pleased to call them that too. And they've both been very well entrenched and committed to the Aboriginal art area for much longer than that. And what's interesting about today's thing is that Vivian is more on the professional, curatorial, academic kind of side of it, and Christopher is dealing more in the industry part of it, whilst he's also an artist, and they both are very concerned about authenticity and ethics and appropriate protocols and treating Aboriginal artists properly. So Vivian, we're starting with Vivian, and she's the curator, as you know, of the Papunya painting out of the desert, and she's a New South Global Professor at the University of New South Wales. She's been researching the history of Western Desert art for almost 30 years. Her monumental Lives of the Papunya Tula Artist will be published by IAD Press, Alice Springs, this year. Is that still the case?
You bet.
And she's also published The Dictionary of the Western Desert Artist, these healthy tomes, and a monograph on Michael Jagamara Nelson, and also on Clifford Possum, which came out in 2003. And she is Editor-in-Chief of the Dictionary of Australian Artists Online Project. So you can go online for that, and that's Australian Artists across the board. And currently an online dictionary of urban Indigenous artists. This is her current project. So the whole field would be nice to cover. I think there's something like, 5,000 in urban? What's the latest count?
No. Those biographies are part of the Dictionary of Australian Artists as well, and there are about over 7,000 biographies in the Dictionary of Australian Artists at this point, but that's barely a beginning, really.
Yeah. Okay, so would you like to just kick off, Vivian,
sure,
with a little chat about collecting
well,
and collectors?
I am actually a sociologist by trade. I didn't mention that. So I think we will, unless anybody indicates their desire to go into why people collect things or something like that at the end of this discussion, we'll move straight on to the exhibition and point out to you that the selection of works in this exhibition was was determined by what was already in a collection which the museum acquired from the Aboriginal Arts Board in 1991. So people ask questions like, why aren't there more paintings from 1971, 72, or why aren't there more Clifford Possums, or all these sorts of questions. Well, it depends what was in the collection. The focus of this exhibition was the very large canvases, because my research on the history of Papunyatullah artists has disclosed that over this period there were very limited markets for this type of artwork. And it was only because the Aboriginal Arts Board, which was established by the Whitlam government and got underway in 1974, the Aboriginal Arts Board of the Australia Council, was the main financial support of Papunyatullah artists over this whole decade, and they commissioned really large canvases for their exhibitions program. But it was a very special moment for each artist when they got their turn at the big canvas. Those of you who came to the previous public programs will remember that it was called the Motokari one, because you could get enough from the proceeds, which was somewhere between $500 and $1,000, depending on the quality, to buy yourself a rundown second-hand car, and that might be the only one you got in the whole decade, if you weren't lucky like Clifford Possum and got several goes at it. So that's the answer to the question of why these paintings. The Aboriginal Arts Board collected paintings the same reason I did, actually, when I first became a collector of Papunya paintings, and that is because no one else wanted them. And the artists, Tim Lura and Billy Stockman, initially, who were on the Aboriginal Arts Board, said, don't give us grants, buy our paintings, no one wants them. We don't want handouts. And so the Aboriginal Arts Board, it being the 70s, said, okay, if that's what you want, that's what we'll do. There was none of the bureaucracy that we experience in this day and age. And also, interestingly, when I did my research on how people used to hang paintings in the 70s, I thought initially that there would be a contrast between the old ethnographic model, because Aboriginal art was thought to belong in museums for the most part in that era. They were still saying that when I went to the Art Gallery in New South Wales in 1980 and said, I need to talk to the director about Aboriginal art, meaning that they should go and buy some. And they said, oh, museums down the road, wrong place, you know. But when I did my research, I found that many of these Aboriginal Arts Board exhibitions showed an extraordinary amount of imagination and daring, because, again, that was the decade we're talking about. And I think perhaps that the brilliant design and lighting of this exhibition may have something to do with some of the slideshows we had in our planning meetings for this exhibition, where they saw what people used to do in those days, when everyone wasn't sitting around saying, you can't do that. It was more, let's just do this thing. As to Geoffrey Bardon, I don't think anyone can diminish his contribution to this art movement. Nobody would want to. But I think his name is virtually synonymous with this art movement in a way that the names of people like Karpa Jampa Jimpa, who is actually the person who started painting in Papunya before Geoff even got there, who won the art competition in Alice Springs before Geoff even knew him, was just as important. And if people go away from this exhibition knowing the name of Karpa Jampa Jimpa, that would be nice. And also the names of... We've organised the exhibition chronologically, and it's named after the people who carried this struggling enterprise through this whole decade of the 70s, without which there wouldn't be an art movement either. So more power to them too. I'll just leave it at that. And oh no, I must have a segue.
Yeah.
I think it's indicative perhaps of this, the way things were going with Aboriginal art. It's amazing now, because this boom has been going on for nearly two decades. But at the end of the 80s, when Chris became involved in this, he was a struggling artist. And it wasn't one of the top-line galleries, Rudy Komen or something, who picked up, as it would be today, who picked up Papunya Tula painting and said, I'll be the local agent. It wasn't a Sydney agent for Papunya Tula artists, and it was this artist who became engaged in it, partly through coming to see the collection that we had amassed at our place, became inspired by it. And it's kind of indicative of just how, I mean, it's ongoing now. It seems as though it's always been like that, but things were very different within actual living memory. Mm. So here's Chris.
Can you hold that thought so I can introduce you?
I'm talking 1989.
Yeah, 1989. Okay, so who we've got here is our other famed guest, Christopher Hodges, and who's the director of Utopia Art Sydney, a contemporary art gallery that exhibits Indigenous and non-Indigenous artists. The gallery has represented Papunya Tula in Sydney since 1988 and the Utopia community from 1988 to 1992 during a period of enormous development and change. Christopher is the chair of the Melbourne Art Fair Foundation, a not-for-profit organisation dedicated to the development of the visual arts in Australia, and a member of the Australian Commercial Galleries Association, which is dedicated to the ethical representation of artists. Christopher is also an artist who has exhibited in solo and group shows since the late 1970s, and his work is included in a number of public, private and corporate collections. Christopher.
Segwaying across from Bill.
Segway.
From Vivian's thrown line, the first time I encountered Aboriginal art was in our museum. It was the Australian Museum in Sydney. And the first time I became confronted with contemporary Australian Aboriginal art was once again in the Australian Museum. And I can still remember these four little paintings by Johnny Warrengoola Juparoola, who were sitting in the middle of an exhibition of spears and shields and a great range of other things that were all fabulously exciting to me. I saw this funny group of paintings and thought, they're just something I've never seen before. They're exciting, and they caught me. You know, there was that little bit where you suddenly think, hey, this is really terrific. Years went by, and I was going through a life, and I bumped into contemporary Aboriginal art again at the National Gallery. I saw some batiks from the Utopia community. But in Sydney, there was no real place that you could see a lot of it often well. And it was by chance in the late 80s, 1988, right at the beginning of 1988, that I became involved by accident with the Utopia community and from there with the Papunya community. And as soon as I became involved, the first person who showed me a collection was Vivian. And Vivian's house was a treasure trove of paintings, many acquired out of loving care and concern for the artists that had made the work, and many acquired because they were absolutely fantastic paintings, and many acquired because they the passion of collecting. And that's what always has interested me, and collections that are made from passion are the ones that give me the tingle up the spine, where you can walk into a house and there'll be some very minor paintings that not, you know, not National Gallery quality at all, but they are lovely works, and side by side with, you know, major paintings that could be in the National Gallery of Australia. And it's that sort of collection that I'm drawn to, the sort of collection that Vivian had. Vivian did her work in the early 80s, and she managed to get one of the paintings that's in this exhibition. I think you had a hand in that, didn't you? Charlie Giappongardi's picture, Getting Into Perspective, at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. It's a beautiful painting by Charlie Giappongardi down there. It was a breakthrough. One of the first times a contemporary painting by an Aboriginal person was actually hung in a contemporary exhibition. And, you know, it was a huge, huge break. There's also a wonderful painting by Clifford Possum Jappaljari that's Wollongong, which is in the Art Gallery of New South Wales' collection, which wouldn't have got there without the passion of, you know, Vivian's passion of saying to them, you've got to get this picture. And if I'm not incorrect, Vivian's partner, Tim, at the time, pricing it very low when it got sold. And it's...
You want to know how much?
1,500. Is it 1,500?
2,500.
Yeah.
So multiply that by 1,000 and you get the price of the next one he painted that's gone to the National Gallery of Australia.
Yeah, so the,
you,
so
2.4 million,
4 million one that just sold.
So to fit it into the context of collecting the subject of today's talk, the exhibition that's downstairs was collected by the Aboriginal Artists Agency trying to do their best in a passionate and caring way for the, for some of their constituents. It's an accidental collection in many ways. You know, it's an accident that, you know, an artist, John Keane, was keen on... John Keane enthusiastically provided bigger canvases to try and get the work. It was an accident that it all got kept. It was an accident that it all got locked away. And it was an accident that somebody found it again and put it back on, back in the public arena. There's a big painting downstairs, the Punkalunka Man, with by Uruta Jangler in the... straight as you come in the front door, which is a magnificent painting, which was a painting that I'd seen in books and reproductions, and you couldn't find it. Nobody knew where it was, this painting. It was a, and here it is.
You know where, you know, it was?
Where?
Neiman Marcus Department Store. About 8 years.
And who found it?
I think the Aboriginal Artists Agency eventually decided that they'd better call off the...
Oh, you've gone down.
The sound's gone. When the museum acquired this collection...
In 91.
It went to the Sao Paulo Biennale in 1983. And then I think it was loaned to Neiman Marcus. The guy from the Aboriginal Artists Agency hastened to assure me that it was hanging alongside Monet's and...
right.
It's a beautiful company, but it is a department store. And then when the National Museum acquired this collection, people had heard of this painting. They said, well... where's the Uda Uda? The call went out, and eventually someone remembered it.
That's where it was.
And so this is a testament to the power of art, because you wouldn't be here if it wasn't for those pictures downstairs, and those pictures have survived, you know, through their own integrity. And that Punkalunka Man picture that we all, you know, all of us who were in the know just wanted to get their hands on, to have a look at how, and, you know, it, it is the jewel in the crown, in my mind, in that collection that's downstairs. And so passion mixed with integrity, mixed with educating yourself as to the breadth of the way, is the way to collect.
Can I just add something to that, Chris? You said that John Keane, who was an artist, came along and gave people big canvases. But one of the really interesting things about this exhibition is that it takes the thing of when people actually started painting on that scale back from the late 70s to 1974. The earliest painting in this exhibition is from March 1974, which is years and years before even the painting in the Art Gallery of New South Wales. And so, Peter Fanning was not an artist, he was a botanist. And the push for big canvases came from the artists.
Yeah.
They were the ones who wanted to paint.
You learn something every day.
And what I found interesting about it was that everyone assumed that the only things that were being painted in the desert at that time were the small boards that we all know about, and they got very celebrated in recent years. But what's really interesting, at the same time as these little boards were being painted, these huge canvases were being painted, almost moonlighting, you know, it's like a done on the side, and the little boards weren't bringing anything either. So there's no way. I think the concern was, well, not bringing as much.
Well, my understanding of it is that, I mean, you look at the auction house thing. All those paintings that are turning the engine of the auction house were in private hands. That's why they're being put up for auction. The public collections don't go up for auction. So there were quite a number of them that went out and were sold. But these big paintings, these big, exuberant, loosely painted, shall we say, messy, you know, paintings that these artists were doing were not what people thought Aboriginal art was supposed to look like in those days. Even people from the Aboriginal Arts Board didn't really think that was what it was supposed to look like. And it's, if those paintings had been painted 35 years later, everyone would have said, wow, you know, but as it was... there were even suggestions that they be sold back to the artists.
I wish they wouldn't be sold back at 2 million. something about just that people might be interested is that some of those canvases in there from 74 have a lot of very bright colours in it. They have a lot of the hot pinks and blues and purples and a whole range of colours that people were not associating with the earth colours of Aboriginal art. Did that mm-hmm. colour selection change? Did art advisors have any sort of input in responding to a market desire for earthiness?
There were instructions that went out after this early period of the thrill of having a much broader palette. And definitely, it was also the punk era, punk pink, punk orange. You see, that was that palette out there, strangely enough. Mm. Which reminds me that the first time I ever met Kapa Jampa Jimpa, he looked like a member of the punk movement. He was wearing a suit coat that was held together with about 50 safety pins.
He was the original punk.
But these paintings weren't selling. The advice went out that people needed to be more neater, more refined, and use this natural palette. And so towards the latter part of the 70s, you do notice this, what's called the Papunya palette coming in. And people were still using colour, but they were mixing greens by putting watery yellow ochre on a black background, which makes it look green. They were doing that rather than like you say, the...
The high key was missing, yeah.
Well, I think given that we have half an hour, I might open it up to the floor and then more information will ensue as responses come your way. So is there anyone who wants to comment on anything so far? Ask questions?
Louise Hamby from the Australian National University. I'm very interested in the nature of the things that were collected from the Aboriginal Arts Board, because in the exhibition, what no one's actually talked about are some of the other objects, which people might in the past have classed as the ethnographic ones, the ones that you should see in the museum. But, of course, a lot of those are painted with the same stories that you'll see on the paintings. So my question is, in this time period, what kind of percentage... paintings versus the painted wooden objects, for example. Were those wooden objects also difficult to sell, or why did the Arts Board buy those in comparison to paintings? And were there other people collecting those and not the paintings? I'm just interested in that juxtaposition between, quote, a fine, what we would now consider a fine art market, and more material culture objects, which are still struggling to find a place, shall we say, in the fine art market, for anyone.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, there's... Well, the artefacts, the carved wooden artefacts, they were the bread and butter of the Aboriginal art industry during that time. And it's only with the enormous success of the canvases that those objects have become, instead of being commonplace and more to be seen than canvases, have become a rarity and practically not to be seen anymore, especially the ones of the quality that you see in this exhibition. And also it's interesting that the industry itself, talking about the origins of this industry and people saying, well, wouldn't have been there without Geoffrey Bardon. Well, the Indigenous art industry actually started a long time ago. A couple of those shields, though you wouldn't think so because they're so similar to the paintings themselves, are from 1936 and were collected by Olive Pink, and they're there to sort of show that this wholly Indigenous initiative industry had been going for a long time before Papunya Tula got started up. Now, in this exhibition, from what your comments, maybe we haven't quite succeeded, but the idea was that these are three-dimensional artworks. I mean, you can look at them in that way. Obviously, some of them also have a practical function. There might be a shield or a carrying dish or something of the sort. Some of them are actually, we're cheating a little bit here in that they're not from the Aboriginal Arts Board collection, and we might have to speak to someone like Bob Edwards to know exactly, or Kate Kahn, or someone who's involved at that time, to know just how much of that kind of material they bought, because they were trying to promote the paintings. But there was actually someone who bought a whole lot of blanks in Alice Springs and took them out to Papunya and got people to do paintings on them, essentially. So, but others were you'll see from the signage which ones were made by those artists themselves. Even the spears were made by Papunyatullah artists. We've tried to carry that theme through so that they're just an extension of their art making, and they're supposed to be hung in a dynamic way so that you're sort of moved beyond just seeing them as material culture, but just as something that the same artist painted. And you can actually recognise, in the case next to the huge painting from John Keane's time by Yali Yala and Shorty Lungata, there's examples of their work, and you're meant to be able to go from there to the painting and work out who painted what, if you're interested in that sort of thing. Mm.
But the marketplace and the institutions have always had problems with those things. And it's the same in the general art market. You can have a painting on a piece of canvas and a painting on a piece of paper by the same artist using the same materials on both surfaces, mm-hmm. but the one on the canvas will sell for more money than the one that's on the paper. It's just a fact of the marketplace. And you can find Shields and Coulomans, which are virtually flat-ish surfaces with beautiful paintings on them by the major artists, and the marketplace looks at them as a slightly different commodity, which has nothing to do with their artistic merit. And many of them were done by the artists really desperate for a way of doing some more art, and they would find an opportunity to paint anything. Clifford Possum, for example, painted on turtle shells, and all sorts of opportunities arose, and many artists used that opportunity to do more. And there's a beautiful carved lizard in there by Tim Lure, and Tim and Clifford did some absolutely superb carvings at the time. And I can only assume that they did them because they wanted to, and they would have got probably more money for a painting. I don't know. Would they?
Well, that's an interesting example. Yeah. That one came in. Tim Lure came up to just as we were leaving in 1980, the first visit to Papunya, and he was carrying this lizard, which we always thought was called Brandy, because it's actually Parenti. Yeah. But anyway, Andrew Crocker, who was totally dismissive of this sort of thing, said carvings for tourists. You know, he didn't want to know about it. And he said, you buy it if you want it. You know, so we did for $100.
Yeah. Well,
it would probably have taken about 10 times as long to make as a painting that you'd buy for $100.
That's right. And it's interesting because some of the artists that I've seen make absolutely exquisite boomerangs and spears and things like that they get paid, the market offers them so little for that exquisiteness of their work that many of them would be discouraged. But many of them kept making it because they actually loved doing it. And see that there's another interesting marketplace situation. I was once in a junk shop in Alice Springs. No, it wasn't a junk shop, but it was a shop. And there was a lovely painted shield there. And it was just a lovely thing. And I said, how much is it? And the lady said it was $80. And I thought, oh, that's okay. And I paid $80. And she said, Tim Lure painted that for me a long time ago. And a Tim Lure painting at the time was thousands of dollars. He'd passed away well and truly by that stage. Thousands and thousands of dollars. And this is a beautiful shield. Yet she saw it as worth nothing more than the price of a shield. And that's commodification I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, do you want to add something? Do you want to finish something quickly?
A little bit. Perhaps what Chris and Vivian are saying seems that perhaps the Australian public perhaps needs a bit of educating in terms of seeing value in something other than paint on canvas. That's all.
Just following up on that, I wondered to what extent that is, in a sense, a reflection between the dichotomy in Western art between craft and fine art.
Quite so.
Well, it's part of the genre. I mean, it's a Western hierarchy of value, that a paint, not only a values range in terms of media, that canvas is more important than paper, which is more important than wood, which is more important than lino cuts, which is more, there's that whole Western tradition of that, the imposition of that value system, but it's also the imposition of something in oil is better than something in water and something better than something in... And then there's a whole genres of history painting is more important than portrait painting, which is more important than... So that all that baggage is what obviously is in the marketplace because they're the people who are buying it, not the blackfellas.
But I can assure you that in 1988, when I first started to try and convince people that they should look at this stuff as art, not anything else, and I included, when I say this stuff, you know, paintings, batiks, watercolours, sculptures, you know, the whole gamut of it, that they should treat, not perhaps not all of it, but at least some of it, because there are some wonderful carvings and there are some rubbish carvings. But I think that the ones that are actually, you know, transcend the craft aspect of it and become, you know, aesthetically, spiritually, the ones that have that something that we call art. Trying to convince museum curators in 1988 that Aboriginal art needed to go into a museum context, it was like pushing, you know, the hardest case. You couldn't do it. The curators, some of them would say, that painting over there, like those colourful ones Vivian's talking about in the exhibition downstairs, some would say, that's Aboriginal, it doesn't fit in a modern art museum. And other people would say to you, that's too modern, that's not Aboriginal. And you'd have this dichotomy of argument going on about whether it was Aboriginal or not Aboriginal. And so in the end, I just used to say, just treat it as a painting and forget who did it. Let's just look at the thing. And it's a scary thing for a lot of people because people like labels and tags and things to be on the bottom of it. But curators took a long time in museums, and they still have problems with it. Aboriginal art is quite often still in a separate section of the institution. But more and more institutions are bringing Aboriginal art as part of today's living culture of our country, and I think it's a really positive thing.
Yeah, there's, as the saying goes, it was too ethnographic for art galleries and not ethnographic enough for museums, particularly this desert movement, so it fell. Yeah. The bark movement was much easier to place because it was on bark, but this was acrylic on canvas, so how can you not, you know, how can you exclude it on the fine art scale I was just talking about?
I actually think it's gone a little bit too far on the art scale myself, and I see this exhibition as an important corrective for people forgetting that they are also more than art.
Mm. Yes, please. Could I address a question to Vivian? You made a significant point earlier on about the fact that a painting by Karpa had won the art prize in Alice Springs even before Geoffrey Bardon had appeared on the scene. And I just think it might be useful. I know you've, in your work on Clifford Possum, have researched this question of art that pre-exists Bardon time at Papunya. And I would just like to hear a little more about that, because obviously there's the tradition of Hermannsburg and Namatjira and so on. Mm-hmm. And I believe some of these artists were part of a crossover from that tradition to this tradition.
Yep.
Could you speak?
Yeah. Well, the painting, if you read a catalogue of an exhibition called Dot and Circle that was put on by Flinders University Art Museum in 1986, and they had, and there was a contribution there from Dick Kimber, who figures in this exhibition as the person, one of the people running Papunya Tula in the mid-70s. But in his essay, he talks about the fact that Karpa's win in this second Alice Springs Caltex Art Prize in August 1971 had an enormous impact, not only in the non-Indigenous art world in Alice Springs, which knocked their socks off, actually, that not only was there an Indigenous entrant in the prize, but it had won, but also the people back in Papunya. There was enough here in one go, was enough to buy a motor car. And Dick Kimber talks about the galvanising effect that had on people who were already working around Geoffrey Bardon was there and the mural was being painted. It's hard to get the chronology exactly right, but my understanding of it was the mural was underway. But it was not Jeff who took those paintings into Alice Springs and put them in the art award. It was someone else who, Karpa was a very, I think he was described by Peter Fannin as the greatest wheeler dealer of all time. and he got someone to take them in and put them in that exhibition for him, and then they won. And it was probably these two things coming together that really just caused that explosion of art activity in Papunya at that time. What did they look like? Well, Jeff has some things to say about that, and if you look in his latest book, there's a couple of examples of them. But generally speaking, he was called Mr. Patton. Some of you may have seen the film about his life that was screened as part of this exhibition a few weeks ago. And that was his focus, that he wanted a wholly indigenous art, as he says. And these paintings, which featured small figures in full body regalia with ceremonial layouts and the paths of the dancers and ceremonial objects and things all through them that, as he saw it, had a strong European influence, and he tried to eliminate that. And if you read what he says about Karpa, he wanted him to go back to what he called his real self, which was to get rid of all these aspects of the style that they had actually developed before Jeff came along.
Figurative style. So that they're understandable by a Western audience.
But the idea of making art based on their own traditions was implicit in those works in the first place, which, though they were different from what later developed under the impact of Jeff, who actually gave them feedback and talked to them about their art and liked some things and didn't like others, and that was a key element as well in the development of the whole situation there.
And you've got to remember that Jeff was out there, you know, basically with no preconceived notion about what he was going to find there. And he befriended these people, but in his own naive way, he thought tradition meant not European. But Karpa wasn't yesterday's man. Karpa was definitely the man of today. And it's interesting, I held one of those paintings in my hand about a month ago, and it's a beautifully executed figure, you know, seated figure with all the body paint on it. You know, really quite lovely. The technique of it is quite lovely. The paint's quite chalky and soft, but the execution of it is brilliant. And Karpa didn't give up the figure. The figure kept going
through
his work.
Have a look at the Tim Lure in this exhibition.
Yeah, Karpa managed quite often. In one painting, he'd have the figure with the real body paint on. He'd have a diagrammatic illustration of the picture. He'd have maybe a dancing board with the picture again displayed on it, and then maybe he'd have the totem pole, and then he'd have a fantastic pattern of landscape in the background of the thing, and somehow he managed to unite those visions together. And being a man that was in both worlds, very much in both worlds, he worked pretty well in both worlds. He captured a lot of really stunning individual images, and Tim Lure was Karpa's mate. And this, look at the figures as they run through there. And they were both terribly inventive people, and terrific artists, and they weren't beholden to anybody.
Well, yes, they were. I mean, the name we should mention here is Namajira. I mean, he was the person who showed everybody that an Aboriginal artist was something to be, you know, and you would get the respect of the highest levels of European society, and you'd get a great big truck from Ampol too.
So, the name emblazoned on the door.
And they were, you know, Clifford was perhaps one who declined to be his disciple, but there are watercolour landscapes out there with Karpa's name on them. If anyone's got any, I'd love to see them.
That's why.
Yeah, anyway.
I think Chris was saying that despite all these influences and being beholden to people, these artists managed to be able to, you know, satisfy lots of bases. I mean, lots of artists, you know, they can do what they need to do. They can also satisfy one kind of market or another kind of market. It's a mobile field.
Yeah, but what I was really saying was that they were artists. They were out there inventing their own language. They didn't stay. They weren't merely reproducing things that they knew time and time again. They weren't, you know, they weren't manufacturing. They were working out new ways of painting pictures. And you could look at the exhibition that Tim and Karpa are using, you know, watery paint, very fluid paint, getting soft and dark and light and strong. And they're painterly things. They're not you know, it's not a traditional thing, and their paintings grew differently, even though they're influencing each other. They're sitting side by side, and Carpa does a bit of something, and Tim sees it, and they're feeding each other. And that artistic endeavour is really important, to see them as artists, not as ethnographic reproducers of tourist items. And there's certainly a hell of a lot of those people around, and not, you know, they were really innovating when they were doing their work.
The method by which they're expressing was innovative, but they're actually still expressing traditional cultural...
Well, every great artist needs a subject. You've got to have your subject. And they had their subject, they knew it well, and that was fueling the content of their art and giving it meaning and giving it potency. But if they weren't any good as, you know, with the brush in the hand and the mind and getting the three of them together, you wouldn't have the power that the paintings project.
Noel Cox, it seems to me, Vivian, that your point about Namatjira is not just apt but interesting, because I was in the painting shed in Papunya in 1977 and bought my first piece of Indigenous artwork there. But the group of people with whom I went to that shed, and also the people with whom I spent quite a long period of time in Alice Springs, one had never heard of anything but Namatjira, and so they expressed no interest whatsoever in the sort of painting that was beginning to evolve there, and that must have been a very frustrating period for those people working in, I suppose, both maybe not a medium that they knew, but working with a background that they understood but nobody else did. So it's not too surprising that not a lot of work was sold to people who didn't understand, weren't interested in anything about that. But the 50s and 60s thing with Namatjira was still really in full swing, certainly at the beginning of the 70s and perhaps even right through the 70s.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And there's a passage in one of Jeff's books too where he talks about the fact that that Carpa and Keith Namatjira, Albert Namatjira's son, and I think Nosepeg, Juparula, used to go around the houses in Papunya in the early 70s trying to flog their various wares, Namatjira-style watercolours, the kind of paintings we were talking about a moment ago from Carpa, or maybe his watercolour landscapes and artefacts around Papunya. I think we all know that. You were saying that the people in Papunya had never heard of Namatjira. No.
Who was with?
Oh, right.
And then the subsequent European folks back in Alice Springs, with whom I congregated at that time, they didn't even know that movement had begun.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Don't worry, there's a hell of a lot of people that were in museums and art institutions who didn't know what was going either. You're not alone. I mean, there's...
That's right.
People tell you, like, for 1988, when I started, people were saying, this is a boom in Aboriginal art, Well, how come I've got to break everyone's arm to look at this stuff? And then it keeps going. Oh, the boom's on. And people, there's still a huge portion of the population that... they know about it now, but they don't know much, really. And there's a growing number of people that show a great appreciation for it. And I think the greatest success of it so far is that through art, you know, not only the visual art, but the arts, a greater number of Australians have got to actually engage with Aboriginal people, at least superficially, and more are engaging with Aboriginal people properly, and actually having an Aboriginal person as a, maybe a friend. And that's been a huge change in our society in the last 20 years.
I just wondered if you'd like to talk a little bit about the emergence of women artists in Aboriginal communities, because one of the very fundamental thing about this exhibition is primarily men. And there was a question earlier on about the role of women, but I think some of the most beautiful and amazing paintings that I see coming now from Aboriginal painters are from some of the women's communities. That might be a bit, but it might be something you'd like to comment on. Vivian, maybe?
Yeah, well, Margot read a comment from someone about the exhibition too that I should have picked up on by now, namely saying that the women didn't have any spiritual life or ceremonial engagement, and of course this is not the case, so it was not for perhaps male anthropologists like Professor Elkin to know this. But I think, as you say, the last couple of decades of art production by women have set everybody straight on this score, if they needed to be set straight. But the fact is that over this period, the whole time when the art movement was struggling for survival, when there were very limited resources, it was, and right back at the beginning too, it was the men who started painting, and in the early days it was very much men's business, not for women even to see. And there's an ongoing issue about a lot of those paintings that were produced in the very early years about their suitability for general display, on the basis that they're actually not suitable for Aboriginal women or uninitiated young men to even see. So I think that's that no one can deny, and it soon when Margot's Emily show hits the museum, it'll be undeniable in this context, if it isn't already realised, that obviously the women have made an enormous contribution. And some of the more feminist inclined artists say that nowadays. Yes. Watty way gone now, that's men, Kumko way now, it's women's way now. And of course, that's a slight exaggeration, but certainly the women have made incredible contribution over the last few decades.
Yeah, the calendar.
But in 1981, there were just a very few women, and they were women who sort of like a lot of pioneers, made their contribution. No one picked it up because people believed that women didn't have any cultural knowledge to impart. And also some of these women had very strict ideas about what should be revealed, and limited themselves to bush tucker themes and so on, that they kind of have been forgotten, even though they were actually some of the first women to paint are those two women whose beginning to be part of the movement is symbolised by those last couple of objects in the exhibition.
I was just going to put the extra point on it that in Papunya, the man, Jeff Barden, was the guy who coordinated the stuff. And at Utopia, there was women who started off the paint movement. So when I went to Utopia in 1988, it was basically a women's movement that the men weren't part of. And when I used to go to a meeting there, the women would be over there and the men would be over there, and you either had to stand in the middle and talk to both groups, or you went and addressed one group and then went and addressed the other group. And it was very much two separate things. And the art coordinators at Utopia had tended to be women, and Rodney Gooch became the art coordinator, who's a man, and so the men came and approached him, could they do it too? And that was a changing place in that situation. So if you look at that cultural thing of the two groups being, separate, and the mediation that was going on, it was not surprising that some of these groups existed on gender lines. At Ernabella they were doing Batik too, and it was basically Batik on gender lines.
Yeah, that's what was the defining difference between the two places we're talking about, is 10 years previous to Chris's 1988, it'd been a Batik movement, so most of the women, which is interesting given it's, it's a Western thing, textiles, but it wasn't necessarily an
indigenous thing. No, but that grew out of the hippie era, because the women that were there on the spot, knew how to tie-dye and do things like that. So it was like Vivian said, Kapa was the original punk, it was the right era for it, and, tie-dyed things were going on. So, and it wasn't that it was, but it was mainly because the women were sitting outside the school, and there was a woman who met the women, and therefore
it was
an opportunity.
A hippie woman who set it up.
Yeah, but an opportunity. Well, I mean, I don't mean that she was a hippie woman, but in that time, tie dyeing was common, But
the so
the people that took the opportunity were the ones that had the opportunity, if you know what I mean. And so at Utopia, when Lindsay Bird got the chance, there was a man there now. He was straight over, but and he began a painting life. So.
OK, Can I also mention Karpa again in this context, in that Karpa was the first person to enlist his wives and daughters to help him with the backgrounds of his paintings. He was a pioneer in that respect as well, much to the dismay of Andrew Crocker, who was a bit of a chauvinist, actually.
And mind you, women in Arnhem Land had been assisting... You know,
well,
daughters and wives had been assisting the bark painters for a good decade or so before that. So, but it had been an assisting... It's just confirming what we're talking about. It had been mostly an assisting roles.
Mm.
Can I just make a quick comment before you go on? I went to see the Sydney Nolan exhibition the other day, and as you walk down the stairs, there's a room that you can see across... And I went up. It is the most wonderful room in this is in the Gardgarry, New South Wales, and it draws on your comments earlier about what's ethnography, what belongs in a museum, what belongs in a gallery. It is just a collection of paintings. There's Lily Kelly Napangadi. There's Fred Williams. It's a collection of landscapes. And what are artists for? They're to help us see our world. You know, they're our eyes. And it is there's women Aboriginal painters, men. There's Australian painters, non-Aboriginal. And it's just one little room, and it's just magnificent. And it's a transformation of the sort of conflicts you were talking about earlier about what belongs where. And much more interesting than the Sydney Nolan exhibition, I thought.
No bias. Look, you know, we're 3:36, and Vivian is conducting a tour about now-ish. So we just really, unfortunately, I know we're kind of really just starting, but unfortunately we'll have to sort of start wrapping up. So if there's, you know, another question out there that absolutely has to be said, throw it in, and then we'll have our two guests with a concluding comment or two, and go for a tour.
Oh, thanks. Oh, in the one of the panels next to a painting by Tim Lurer, it says something about the work looking soft and watery, and that he was drawing on watercolours that he'd done.
Mm-hmm.
Was that sort of Namajira-style watercolours that he'd done, or...?
Yeah, well, he's drawing on his background in that style of
watercolour. So he had actually done some of those?
Well, I don't know. I've actually never seen a Tim Lurer watercolour. But you can see the influence of that style of painting in the way he mixes colours, the way he puts washes over it and so on. You can see that if he hadn't actually done them, he must have sat around when Karpa was doing them. Mm.
That flow across from artists, I think, was very important. It's certainly that school of painting idea where people are always feeding each other's ideas. And in Alice Springs, all of the artists that are from the Central Desert, they've got one eye on what everyone else is doing, just the same as when I go to an art exhibition, I've got one eye on what everyone else is doing too, because you don't want to miss out on a trick, you know. I'm not talking about stealing their style, it's just a painterly trick. And they certainly had it. Although there's a good story that goes with the Emily Noiré exhibition that's going to travel to Japan, and there's a painting of Emily's, and there's one pink and white, and it's strong, vibrant colours. But the last painting in the series is like a ghost. It's just all this pale, 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 watery pink, a pale, pale, watery white. And I said, this is lovely, you know, this pale one here. And she said, yeah, ran out of paint.
And also there's one about Sol Witt being influenced by Emily.
Oh, yeah, this is a story that goes from the Venice Biennale. Emily Noiré was one of the three artists representing Australia at the Venice Biennale, and she had basically in that exhibition there were the stripe body paint pictures and the what are called the yam root pictures as the main works. And a lot of people were contemptuously saying that, oh, she's just seen Sol LeWitt. And, of course, Emily Noiré had never seen Sol LeWitt and never wouldn't have known who Sol LeWitt was. But it was a little quiet put-down that was going on all over the place. And, of course, then the one person that did see the exhibition that was terribly moved was Sol LeWitt. And he thought she was fantastic. And it was so appreciative of her work that he pursued it to actually get one for his own collection. And so it shows you that we can all make, you know, some observations that are, you know, you need to learn a bit more about sometimes.
And John Calder kept sending Emily as a solar wit or prints or pictures or something to feed his appetite for being influenced by Emily. So we're talking about this influence sort of around Alison in Bapanya and so on, but it also spreads much wider. Mm. Last question.
You tell us it's about 30 years since some of this material has seen the light of day. What happens with it tomorrow?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for asking that question. Back to the vaults.
Yeah.
Well, look, the museum has talked about maybe putting it on again another time, maybe doing a tour. I can only hope so, because it would be a terrible waste if it were to languish unseen for another generation, would it not?
And on that note, can I just comment that I found the lighting sensational.
Brilliant.
Instead of having dark paintings on white walls with bright ambient light, we had stained glass windows in a cathedral. It's beautiful.
There's like illuminated manuscripts, I saw.
Yeah, well, more power to the lighting guy who came in a wheelchair. And
in
did
a wheelchair?
That. Yeah.
How much more of it?
Well, we've used almost all of the big canvases.
That is in this collection.
There's lots of smaller paintings. But in terms of the whole Aboriginal Arts Board collection, there's what you call a diaspora. All around the world, the Aboriginal Arts Board left parts of its collection, left exhibitions in the place where they were originally installed. Yeah. I have a dream that one day we maybe put it all back together, or at least take this part of it to where the rest of the parts of it is.
What Vivian didn't say is because these works at the time of production were not marketable as such, the Aboriginal Arts Board collected them to put into their international exhibition program. So the works went overseas to lots of embassies and outposts of various sorts. And then over the decade or two, they kind of got lost, left, you know, in various dark cupboards in various places, and Vivian's been researching this area for some time and trying to locate them.
Well, there's four paintings in that exhibition that are from the New Zealand diaspora. There's 20 over there altogether, and as you can see, they're brilliant paintings. That would be stage one, perhaps, of the tour.
And I believe Papunya still doesn't have an exhibition space.
In Papunya, they don't have an art... they've got an art centre, but it doesn't have a building, and they won't even let people paint on the verandas of the derelict houses because the intervention force intends to fix them up one fine day.
It's a whole new story. Thank you very much, and I know people are just getting wound up, as always happens near conclusion. So I want to thank you very much for being such an attentive and enthusiastic audience, and hope this is simply the beginning of a very long journey for lots of you, and a further stimulation to become more interested. And I'm sure Vivian and Christopher, if you can grab them after, we'll have a chat with you.
Vivian's taking a tour.
Yeah, that's right. Vivian's going to take a tour. And thank you very much to Christopher Hodges for coming to... coming all the way from Canberra. And I suspect he only ever has come to National Gallery of Australia exhibitions previously.
Not true.
Almost always. But that's changing, just as this show will change many things around here. And, of course, Vivian Johnson also came all the way from Sydney, but she's done it lots and lots of times over the last 6 months. So Vivian is...
Thank you,
Marco. Oh, who's she? Thank you. Well, you'll all be back when Emily's here.
Yeah.
August 21st, roughly, we'll be doing a selection from the show, because the one in Tokyo and Osaka is over 2,000 square metres, and here we've got 1,000 square metres, but we are a museum and you can cram them in more. Because we're not into minimalism and too much wall between here. So, you know, that's one of the advantages, I guess. So look out for August.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.